The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? First off, apologies. Two apologies, actually. One, I've just put a very delicate cycle of washing on in the apartment that I'm in Brighton. So if there's a background of low rotation drum swirls, then I'm really sorry. And also, as you can hear, the church bells have been going for about 45 minutes at the moment when I've been trying to record this intro. So we're just going to have to bear with all these slight annoyances. How are you? You good? Are you having sonic problems as I am? I hope not. I hope you're having no problems. I hope you're having a fantastic week. My second apology, again, is to you. Sorry for no new episode last week. For those that aren't on social media, I did make an apology and let you know. I was just kind of up to my neck filming. I'm here in glorious Brighton by the seaside, currently doing a few weeks in a CID office with a lot of police speak, and it's quite difficult, but we're getting there and having fun. But it was just too hard to get a guess. My God, these church bells. But we're back this week, and I was lucky enough. So a few weeks ago, my friend Alex, who works at Channel 4, asked me to watch a new one-off TV film that Mark Mundon has directed. Mark Mundon is my guest, by the way. With Jodie Comer, starring Jodie Comer and Stephen Graham, written by Jack Thorne, and I watched it. I was broken and devastated, and I watched it again, and I saw beauty in the devastation. It's a harrowing watch, but it's an important watch, and then it got me thinking about Mark and about his past work, which, look, Mark's won, he's won three BAFTAs. He's been nominated seven times for a BAFTA. He's won all sorts of awards. He's just a fantastic director who all the people I know, all my very, very close friends who have worked with him have said, oh, yeah, no, you'll get on, you'll have a good chat and it'll be fantastic. So I was thrilled that he said yes. And as ever with everybody that I invite to come on, I let them know kind of how, you know, the format is, that we don't necessarily talk about work that much. Sometimes we might go personal if they're okay with that. And, you know, it's not for everybody. And it was for Mark, and I was thrilled. We'd met ever so briefly years ago socially, but we haven't worked together. So it's always a gamble. So I kind of rolled the dice and went with it. And I was saying to Griff before, yeah, I was a little bit nervous when you start, but you just don't know how people are going to react when you hit record and you start going, you know, all over the shop. But look, you're going to know Mark. His work in Utopia was groundbreaking. National Treasure, The Third Day, which we talk about. Now, if you didn't see The Third Day, big shout out to Shaheen Baig casting, who did such an exceptional job on that. We talk about Jude Law's performance in that, and Help, obviously, we touch on that. But we do start right back to a documentary that Mark shot in 1990, 1991, and then we sort of start connecting themes and links that seem to crop up in Mark's work. We talk about the trust he has with actors, certain processes that he goes through, his inspirations, who he worked with, you know, when he was just starting out. And I'm talking about Derek Jarman, Terrence Davies, I'm talking about Mike Lee. Incredible, incredible auteurs of the you know, the film business. And also something we didn't talk about, I mean, we didn't get into it, I think we mentioned it very, very briefly. There's a film that was shot, or certainly aired in 2007, called The Mark of Cain. It's with Gerard Kearns, Matthew McNulty, directed by Mark. And it's still a stunning piece of work. And I spoke to Channel 4 to see if it was on their catch-up service, and it didn't seem to be. So I'm hoping that's going to be on. But if you can catch it, then do. But I think it's really important that you do look up Bermondsey Boy. It'll be under like a TV series documentary, Bermondsey Boy, Mark Munden on YouTube. Maybe you could watch that, because we do talk about that quite a bit. So it'd be quite good for you to get some sort of frame of reference with that. But if you don't, and you can't, or you don't want to, you don't have time, then that's totally fine. This is a fantastic episode. So, yeah, I'm really, really thrilled that Mark's come on. And I think I'm right in saying, after all these years, Mark Munden is our first film director that he's come on. Which is, yeah, we need to have more, don't we? And we're going to. Don't worry, I've just booked another one today, and it's very, very exciting. Let's get the church bells and the delicate cycle of my washing machine out of your ears, and let's get into it. This is the Two Shot Podcast with the quite brilliant, to be honest, Mark Munden. Enjoy, and I'll see you at the end.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Can you hear me, by the way? Yeah, is it good quality?
I've got you loud and clear. Okay, How's mine? Cool. I've just got back to Brighton. I had 2 days off and answered my son for a week. So I did 416 mile in 48 hours. But it's got to be done. It's got to be done.
Yeah.
And I was with him, and last night we We were in a hotel last night. He said, I've got to show you what I've been working on. I said, all right, show me.
How old is he, by the way?
He's 10. He's 10 years old. Right. And he loves film. He loves movies. And we didn't have a TV for years because I said, unless you want to watch like a big film, we'll go to the pictures to watch it because that's the way to watch films. And then there was one time we were traveling somewhere and he started watching a Jurassic Park film on the iPad, and I went, I'm going to have to just get you a big old telly because that's the way to watch your films. And anyway, he was telling me last night, he got his phone out. He said, so what I've done, and he makes trailers for films that he would want to work on and want to...
Oh, right, cool.
And he sort of records things, then he puts the music on, and sometimes it's with action figures, sometimes it's with Lego. And I went, and it got me thinking about like our conversation today, because I thought, well, this is a 10-year-old who's got access to this technology now. But obviously, when you started even dreaming about storytelling and filmmaking and drama, you didn't have any of that, did you?
No, I mean, everyone's making films, aren't they? I've got a 24-year-old son, and he just sort of he did a master's degree, but before that, he was doing a product design degree, and they were making films all the time, you know, to present their products or whatever, or their ideas. And it was just second nature, you know, there they were on iMovie, just sort of cutting this stuff together and, yeah, doing all sorts of clever things. And you know, young people's knowledge of the grammar and you know, is amazing. I mean, it's sort of daunting, really. My generation sort of cobbled it together from scraps of Super 8 film, is how I made my first film, you know. And you had to see what, you know, what came back, as it were, you know. So it was all very experimental, that.
Which was what, Mark? What was your first film?
I made a film called Beverly Hills' Bournemouth with Sunshine. And it was about a man who was a professional gambler, professional poker player,
right,
who made his living in the casinos of Bournemouth.
those famous casinos of Bournemouth. Yeah.
The very glamorous world of Bournemouth gambling.
Mate, I'm born and bred in Blackpool. I know all about the glamour of the seaside towns, yeah.
Yeah, and he made a living doing that, but it was a sort of quite an experimental film, shot on Super 8, and then all the sound was done afterwards. You know, there were interviews with him, and it was really about the relationship between him and his wife, who they both lived in this little bungalow in Bournemouth, and all the money that he made, she ploughed into gilding the taps and the light fittings. And so it was this sort of, and he was quite a sort of spiritual, rather airy, fairy person, and she was very, very practical. And it was really about this sort of, this odd partnership between the two of them.
Well, speaking of partnerships, there's sometimes it's what isn't said that's so important and so powerful. And there's certain scenes in the documentary Bermondsey Boy between Dave and his wife, and there's a very specific scene that springs out of me when they're in that Chinese restaurant, and I don't know what she's saying, but I know that she's not happy, but she can't say anything. And, you know, watching that again today, I found myself at once sort of laughing. And I think there was times, because I'd been with my sort of 10-year-old, and I think there's certain scenes with Dave's boy who's around that age, maybe slightly younger. Yeah. So I found myself laughing at one point and then deeply upset at other times. I thought, oh, my God, it's just horrific. Just, so for those that have never seen Bermondsey Boy, I think it's important that we get a little bit of backstory on that. God knows I need some backstory on it because it's, I mean, it was, did it come out in 91 or did you shoot it in 91?
Yeah, it came out in 1991, yeah.
Right.
We shot it the previous year. It's a film about, it's a documentary about a man who is going through a case, a court case for a charge of GBH. Mm. And as he goes to the court every day, to face his charges, we intersperse it with his current life, which is carrying on the same debt collecting that he was doing when he was charged with the GBH charge, and it follows him throughout his life, you know. But you know, I think the thing about it at the time was, I mean, it effectively was my first film, even though I'd made something before. But it was the first film in a professional situation where I was using proper camera people and sound and things. And at the time, it felt very, I think it was very, I think documentaries were a little bit more removed and a little bit more observed. And actually, we just immersed ourselves in Dodgy Dave's world and went on these journeys with him, including the evicting of squatters and the debt collecting and things like that. And that felt, I'm not sure how it would feel today, but at the time, it felt very, you know, breaking a lot of taboos in terms of the documentary tradition, which was seen to be a little bit more observational and removed.
Well, it was almost like, because, you know, you document it so well, fashion played such a high part. There was a lot of posturing going on. I mean, I've never seen anybody wear sunglasses but have that very slim gold chain around their neck. And it's all about the mannerism of him. And there's, when it's a few days, I think, before he's up in court, and you could plonk certain bits out of that documentary and sort of put them in the office. Because his wife's doing something in the kitchen and he's just parading around his house just saying not guilty, not guilty, in all different sort of mannerisms. And then he turns to his wife and he goes, just practicing. And he's just go, oh my God, one moment. It's so absurd and so hilarious. And then those other scenes, you know, when he's with a group of his, I want to say friends, I don't know if they are, and they've got the dogs and they're baiting the dogs. And at any moment, it could slip over into something very dark and very, I mean, it is dark, but very nasty. And his son's there, and quite clearly, he's a bit affected by it. So, I mean, tonally, it just shifts all over the place. It's interesting because it harked me back when I was watching Help a while ago, to sort of quite woozy, dreamlike stuff, especially when Jodie's got that, I think it's about 22-hour shift that she's on, and it's that, I don't know, do we call it a set piece? I don't know, but it seemed like it went on forever and I couldn't really breathe, and then thank God there was a commercial break after it.
But commercial break.
Damn it. But then it went, you know, there's certain scenes in Bermondsey Boy where Dave's in the bath, and he's fully naked, and then all of a sudden he curls over into sort of fetal-like position, and it is dreamy, and it is kind of woozy. Has there always been, how much coaxing did he need for that? Was that something that he wanted to do? Was it something you wanted to do?
He loved being filmed, and that was another sort of taboo, I think. You know, the beginning of the film is really very much him sort of, you know, making love to the camera, you know. I mean, it's very much about that, but I wanted to try and use that to show what he was really like, to try and get behind what that was, you know. He didn't like being filmed in the bath naked, because he said...
Oh, he didn't?
Yeah, no. He didn't realise that we were going to show his knackers, he said. So he and he was a little bit, you know, he said if he'd known, he would have got a bit of a semi on. But so he didn't like that. But you know, he couldn't have been a more sort of... I mean, I got really quite close to him, you know, and... you know, I was both sort of intrigued and frightened by the whole thing. And I think it just naturally became this, you know, there were all sorts of elements in it which you wouldn't normally see in a documentary, like someone naked in the bath, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was him sort of facilitating all that, you know. And, you know, we stayed close for quite a long time after that. You know, of course, you know, he, you know, he's still around. He makes lots of documentaries and stuff, you know, for his own, you know, channel. But the dreamlike thing, I think, just came out of that relationship, you know, that, the, you know, the sort of being able to push the boundaries of what one's able to do as a sort of portrait, you know, because it, effectively it is a portrait, and it's a portrait of someone on the fringes of society in some sort of way. It's a portrait of someone who I don't think the BBC audience of the time would, you know, a lot of the BBC audience of the time would have seen very much of, and it was trying to get an insight into that. And also, I think it was, you know, I was young, it was my first sort of professional film, I wanted the shock as well, and that, and it was, you know, it was shocking, and I, you know, sometimes it was, you know, there are things that I think in retrospect were quite dangerous to film, and there were things that in retrospect I probably would have done differently. I think it's a little, you know, we, that, you know, for instance, there's a scene where we are with Dave as he goes to collect a debt from a man who owes a gambling debt, and he's obviously not able to pay. He's quite
he's old.
Poor. He's old.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's quite poor. And we're in there with him. And I think, you know, I think that felt a little bit, it's uncomfortable, you know. And I think it was probably quite unfair to him in retrospect. But, you know, it's done in the context of the whole, of your sense of, you know, how can, you know, of your sense of being immersed, of being complicit in some sort of way with those debt collections and that those evictions.
But I mean, that's what I mean about the tonal shifts of a documentary back, you know, in 91. That's why when I was rewatching and I was thinking, do I remember this in the way I did? And I went, oh, maybe because I'm older now, but I like to find myself laughing and then be shocked and a bit scared at some point. And then I was thinking, well, how much was anything orchestrated by him at that point? Because that the Chinese restaurant scene, about what isn't said, but also what we see on screen, you've got his, and I say friends again, but eating glass, and there's some dangerous stuff in there. And I just thought, how did you feel as a filmmaker at that point?
Nothing was orchestrated in the sense of it being sort of rehearsed or anything. I mean, that the Chinese restaurant scene was, to put it in context, a local Chinese restaurant in the Old Kent Road where they had a Chinese Elvis impersonator who was quite well known at the time. But and he comes, you know, and they get a big table in the restaurant, and Elvis starts singing, and they just completely disrupt the act by dancing on stage with him. I think a fair amount of substances were taken that day. But stuff like the eating the glass and Dave's wife being really unhappy with it all, and it's all, you know, it's documentary, you know. So yeah. And of course, I'd come from a fictional background. I didn't come from a documentary background. You know, I'd worked with Mike Lee and Terence Davis and Derek Jarman before that, and my approach was a sort of a fictional approach in the sense of wanting to tell a story and wanting not for it not to be a sort of handheld observational approximation of something. You know, I wanted it to look like a movie, you know. And so those, that, you know, it is very controlled. The, you know, the style of it is very controlled, you know, and that was quite, I think, quite unusual for that time as well.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, I wasn't just saying about any orchestration, but it's just the fact, and you said yourself, how much Dave immediately loves the camera. He's obviously a natural born storyteller, and obviously thought about what he was wearing in every sense.
And, yeah, and the film's about that. It's about that, you know, because it was in a series about masculinity. So it was really about the sort of peacocking of that. And he's a natural. I mean, he was a sort of a pretty extraordinary, interesting, intelligent character. You know, a bloke. You know, who was. You know, it was as a subject, you know, I've often thought of going back to do a sort of follow up, but I'm not sure what more it would be, you know, but he gave me so much and he was so honest that it was a gift and it did me a lot of good as a first.
It would be interesting to go back and see now, but whether whatever anybody would get out of it, but as a companion piece to see it side by side, that would be interesting.
Yeah.
But now let's moving on from sort of a subject's background. Can we talk about your background and growing up?
Yeah.
So where are we with you growing up?
Well, I was brought up in North London between Golders Green and Swiss Cottage. My dad was a documentary filmmaker, actually, who worked for the Ministry of Information during the war. He made propaganda films and, you know, all sorts of things. You know, if you work for the Ministry of Information, you've made films on how to bone a herring, as well as, a story about a shunter saving his railway because there was a bomb on it. You know, it's stuff like that. And it was my father's second marriage, so he was older. And so he'd worked during the war and made a really... Actually, the most interesting film is a film called Song of the People, which is an extraordinary piece, which is in the BFI archive, which is a musical about the history of working class people in Britain. So it's a history of Britain told without kings and queens, but as a musical. And it starts off with this huge shot of people in a machine shop behind their machines singing, you know, in chorus. You know, there's probably about 100 of them, you know, singing this including Bill Owen who was
Last of Summer,
a young man, and that's where it starts, and it tells a story of the diggers and the levellers and working people throughout Britain. So that was his, and it was made for the Manchester Cooperative Society in 1945. So that's the piece that is really sort of notable. But he died when I was 13, so I never managed to talk about film with him. He was away a lot before that, and I really didn't ever get to know him. You know, I mean, he was at home, but at that age, I was too busy playing football and doing other stuff. You know, I suppose the notion of being a filmmaker might have been planted somewhere back there, but I didn't really have any help with that or anything, you know. So that was my background. And my mum sort of soldiered on as a single parent, you know, bringing my sister and I up. I went to a grammar school in North London. It's quite mixed, culturally quite mixed, you know, very different from how North London is now. You know, it was sort of a lot more sort of emigre intellectuals, and, you know, Hampstead was a sort of place of sort of was really interesting as opposed to just being moneyed like it is now. You know?
Very different to what it is now then, yeah.
that was my upbringing, really.
And where did your love of storytelling come from then as you got older? Because you wouldn't have been, I mean, I say this to younger actors all the time who their careers officers sort of scoff at them for wanting to become an actor. Certainly if you went in there and went, I want to tell stories, I want to direct, then they would have gone, okay, well, yeah. I'm sure that's going to happen at some point, but maybe in your spare time.
Well, I was quite academic at school, and I was very good at maths, and I actually went on to University College London to study maths. As soon as I got there, I realised that it was a big mistake. I just wasn't that good, you know. You know, if you can imagine all those great, you know, young kids who are brilliant at maths, and I was there. But the thing that happened was, they had a fantastic film society there where they'd show films every week. Later on, Christopher Nolan became the president of it, but it was well known for its film society, you know. So I watched for the first time European art house films, you know, which I'd never really seen. You know, my father had died before we ever, you know, we wouldn't have seen things like that, you know, when we were young. Jacques Tati, I remember seeing Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, which was is one of my sort of desert island films. But apart from that, not, you know, I hadn't seen Bergman and Fellini and all the, you know, all the French. And that was a big moment for me, sitting in the cinema and thinking I shouldn't be doing maths, and you know, thinking these are amazing, these pieces of work, you know, they were totally inspiring. So that was a big sea change, a big moment for me, you know.
And was it there and then, did you make a decision? Did you think, there's a calling now? Because you're getting, the thing is, you were saying about, well, there was no Fellini, there was no art house, because certainly when I was growing up in the north, that wasn't accessible to me. There was one cinema in Blackpool, and we're lucky to have like three big screens, and there were Saturday morning films that I would go to at 10, 10:30. But a lot of all my influences and back knowledge was all from BBC Two, from like Harold Lloyd and Laurel and Hardy. And that was the first time I used to sit with my granddad and watch all this old comedy and think, man, this is fucking on. But I mean, it's so skillful. It's like a ballet, but it's hilarious at the same time. Why aren't I seeing this more?
Yeah, beautiful. All those films were shown on BBC Two, you know, in those days. I mean, including art house films as well. But also because I went to UCL and I lived in halls, I was right in the centre of London. So the Scala was there, you know, starting up. And, you know, in the days when they had all-nighters there, but also bands, you know, Throbbing Gristle and punk bands and things like that, you know. So... It was a Eraserhead. I saw Eraserhead there for the first time, you know. So there was a lot of other stuff around the university. So I think I was very spoilt in terms of access to films. And I did spend my 3 years watching films, you know. I mean, that and decided that that's what I was going to do, that I was going to be a filmmaker. So
you carried on with the core, with the maths?
I totally flunked my first year, and I did a joint degree in philosophy and maths. I moved courses and actually managed to get a degree with that. But at least that was something that I was quite interested in. You know, there was it's a sort of, in those days, UCL was like it was a Russell Group university. It's quite academic. They didn't have film courses or anything like that. They just had a film society and great theatre and all sorts of things like that. You know, of course, you know, RADA was there as well. So you're right next to RADA. But I carried on, doing my degree and sort of just, you know, limped through my degree and got out the other end, and then sort of decided that I was going to, you know, I was going to buy a Super 8 camera and make some stuff, you know. So that's how I did it. And I sort of worked as a runner on films and on commercials and stuff like that. And then in between those films, I'd make a little bit more of my film, you know, my gambling film, you know. And so that's the way that I did it. And and worked it like that. And eventually, when I finished the film, I sent it around to lots of people, and this man called Paul Watson, who was the man that invented the family, who made the family in the 70s, which was the first sort of fly on the wall. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It was the first fly in the full series about a family in Reading, you know, observational, sort of really interesting for its time. But he was running a department in the BBC, and he was the last of the Mavericks, you know. He was someone that had seen, he'd seen my gambling film and said, is it a documentary? I said, yeah, I hope so, you know, because it was quite odd, you know, it's quite an experimental film. And he said, come and make some films for the BBC. And that's how I got into making, you know, documentaries for the BBC. I mean, it's really, it was a particular thing. I, when people ask me now, how did you get into film? I know that there aren't those avenues anymore. You know, there are none of those mavericks in places like the BBC or whatever, where you could actually just go and they'd give you, he said, come and make a few films and make some mistakes, you know. And
wow, being given a chance to make mistakes.
Yeah, that was part
of
me, it.
That's,
you know,
incredible.
Yeah. And it was really, it was just sort of, yeah, it was a sort of glorious time. It was, I joined, and Penny Woolcock, who's another, well, she's a really interesting political filmmaker. It was her and I, and we made this series called From Wimps to Warriors, which was, Bermondsey Boy was the first one of those, of that, you know, was one of those films in that series. So,
and when did you, how did you meet Terence Davis?
I was making my living as a runner, you know, so I'd worked on commercials and little films, and someone said, you know, the BFI are making this film, and I'd never heard of Terry before. I mean, I tried to get into the film school. I couldn't get into the film school, National Film School, this is, which is where he had been. Because that was the thing that I did when I left university. I thought, you know, if I can make some money as a runner, then maybe I could get into film school and learn how to make films. Someone at the BFI said, if you're a runner, you know, by that time I was quite experienced. So they said, come and be a, you know, a second assistant director on this film. And it was really, really low budget, you know. But of course it was Distant Voices Still Lives, and it's a, you know, it's a classic. You know. It was a magical time. I mean, it was an interesting script because, of course, Terence Davis has, you know, It's not going to be on paper. It's all in his head. It's all this vision. So the script almost read like a student film. There was absolutely no way that you could tell what sort of a film it was going to be. It could have been awful or it could have been great, you know. But as he started to sort of, as I watched the scenes unfold, I just realised it was just absolutely unique in the way that he's constructed stuff. So that was... that was a great experience, and my first experience in Liverpool, funnily enough,
which brings us up to date, really, because I do want to jump forward slightly. I mean, we'll just jump around all over the place with these conversations, and I was thinking about walking out of a cinema years ago. This is I think I'd just broken up with an old girlfriend. I was in my 20s. I was living in London. And I went to the Odeon on Panton Street. And I was sort of getting into Michael Winterbottom's films at the time. And John Sim, who's like a friend of mine. I know you know him.
Yeah.
He was years above me at Blackpool Fire College. And Blackpool Fire College is no longer there in its structural form where it was. It's turned into flats now, sadly. But it's where, you know, John went and David Thewlis went. And like being an actor from the Northwest, you go, well, if they're doing it, then I'm going to really try my best. So I knew John was in it. I thought, I'm going to go and see this. And I sat down and I watched the first 25 minutes and I went, no, no, this is rubbish. I'm going. And I walked out the cinema and it took me like a good year or so to go, no, that's, it's not the film. It was me. I wasn't in the right headspace at the time to sit down and watch this quite sort of handheld filmmaking. I haven't seen lots like it before. Again, it was slightly woozy, or maybe it was me. Maybe I was just upset at the time. And then I was thinking, when I was watching Help, people might not be ready to watch this right now because they might not be in a certain place within themselves. So going into that with your preparation, knowing that you're going to shoot it, were you thinking forward about that? Or were you thinking, or maybe it's going to be in the archive now and people can just pick it up when they're ready?
It's a good question. I mean, I definitely, one of the things that I just didn't want to do was to trigger people. I mean, that was a big thing that we talked about a lot, you know, the idea of triggering people that might have been through it. I think, you know, the main thing for me was to try and make it as honest as possible, which is why there's very little, that central section that you're talking about, which is, you know, where Sarah, Jodie Comer's character, is trying to rescue this man who's suffocating. That, you know, I just wanted us to be with her and observe her, you know, and observe the real horror of it. And I think also that there's something about, rather than it being too soon, which it may well be too soon, you know, depending on your state. And I know it was interesting watching it the other day go out because I had it in parallel with Twitter. So I was watching the Twitter feed go through. People were very, you know, were getting quite upset. And but sort of almost everyone felt like it was, like it had been, you know, there was no artificiality about it, and that pleased me. And also, we're still going through it. I mean, yeah, exactly. There's a lot of people for whom Freedom Day is not Freedom Day at all. It's going, you know, people that have health issues and and the disabled. I mean, that they are still right in the middle of it, despite Freedom Day. And I wanted it to sort of, you know, spark a debate as well, to make people angry, you know, that this is still going on, you know.
Which I think it has, by the way, and I think that's really important because I've listened to certain radio plays over the past 18 months and watched some dramas. I mean, I'm talking about maybe one or two that have been the backdrop of the pandemic, and they've mainly focused on the crumbling structure of relationships. And it's like, well, look, we all know about the divorces and that's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is what's happening. And you know, it has happened, and it would not have been sugarcoated at all. Or the one thing I don't think you do as a filmmaker, nor you have done with anything, and I remember when I first saw The Mark of Cain, you don't sugarcoat your storytelling. You don't spoon-feed the audience. And I think it's so important with whatever story you're telling, but certainly with this.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot. I think that's right. I mean, I like to challenge. You know, I think audiences like to be challenged. I mean, there's Absolutely. Just so much stuff on TV, you know, that is not doing that. And I think people want to be challenged, and they want to make their own decisions about stuff. You know, but I think. I think, you know, obviously a lot of that came from Jack Thorne as well, who wrote this fantastic script. And then it was taken on a stage further by Stephen Graham and Jodie Comer coming together and bringing their own friendship, their own love for each other's work, their own love for each other, you know, into that, those two characters, you know, and sort of elevating that to another level, you know. So it's really, really cooking. And that there was a sort of honesty that came through that as well. And also I think I sort of feel that it's not just the subject. I'm sort of interested in challenging people's, I said this before, but I think TV's really good about tackling difficult subjects, and it does that a lot. But I'm not sure it's so good at tackling those subjects in a way which might be challenging for the audience, or might be formally difficult as well. So the notion of sort of being with someone for 26, 28 minutes while they're trying to revive a man who's not breathing. And it's quite monotonous. She goes to the phone, she comes back from the phone, she goes back to the phone, you know. I liked the idea of the audience not being able to turn away in some sort of way. You know, they're compelled by this. They're immersed in that horror with Sarah. They're experiencing this sort of the dread that she experienced, you know. And just as you might in a horror film, except this is real. I liked the challenge to the audience of that, and actually what's interesting is people rose to that challenge. You know, no one turned off, you know, no one said, oh, you know, this is boring, she's just walking back and forth, you know. And that's because it felt very real, you know. That's exactly what carers were going through when they weren't being able to get GPs on the phone, or 111, or the emergency services weren't sending ambulances out. I think people were compelled by that truth, I suppose.
And also, I mean, I disagree. I didn't find it monotonous at all. I remember the first time I watched it, I thought, I'm going to go and have a bath and go to my bed because I had an early day, but I'm going to watch this tonight. And it was one of those things I almost didn't want to watch, but I was so compelled because the stakes just kept rising and rising and rising until she gets Stevie's character out to help. And even then we raise it again, but it was horrifying but I couldn't turn off and I couldn't look away. And I think it's such, and I'm sure you've been told this many times, it's such an important integral part of that whole story. And I know, yeah, of course you've got a brilliant script to work from, but It all just came together for me. I thought it was really good. I'm not going to carry on giving lots of praise, but do you know what I mean?
Also, the other thing that I learned, though, was that, last year I did this series for HBO and Sky Atlantic called The Third Day, and in the middle of it was a performance by Punch Drunk Theatre, who were involved with the whole genesis of the series, and that was a 12-hour film where we actually, you know, sort of, you know, we walked through that island with this passion play that Jude Law was in for 12 hours, and including watching him dig his own grave for an hour, and also traveling across the causeway to the island where the ceremony was in real time, which took, you know, sort of 48 minutes or something, you know, with nothing but the odd bird flying past. But what people were really, really drawn to that. And I'm, you know, people, I doubt if anyone sat down and watched the whole 12 hours, but people actually, you know, absolutely had it on. And that was another one where the Twitter feed and the Facebook feed was going crazy on that sort of stuff, you know. But I thought that was really, really interesting, because I thought people were very you watch that sort of moving image in a very, very different way. You know, you digest it in a very, very different way. It's mesmerizing. It's a sort of almost like a meditation when there's very, very little thing. Right. You know, and I thought maybe I can bring some of that to this sequence, you know. I've done it before, you know, maybe we can sort of combine the two things. I think the audience has a, you know, has an appetite for that sort of challenge, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so funny because you mentioned the third day, because that's the other thing I was going to come onto, because I'm still connecting all these dreamlike sort of states and this wooziness that keeps cropping up in your work all the time, never more so than in the third day. I mean, yeah, I mean, talk about pushing the boundaries. I'm going to do a 12-hour live. I mean, I know we do want to push boundaries and challenge the audience, but how did you feel when that was approached to you by, well, I mean, I take it was by Punch Drunk.
Yeah, Felix Barrett. So Felix Barrett and Dennis Kelly, who was the writer of the series, initiate the project together, you know, and part of it was... after the third episode was going to be a Punch Drunk show. So it was something that you got to the third episode on the TV, you watched it on the Sunday, and then the following Saturday you applied in a raffle to get a ticket to go to this show, one of 2,000 people, to go to the island and actually be in the television show, you know. And obviously you'd seen it up to that point, so it was obviously going to be a bit of a, you know, a challenge, or a, you know, you've got to, you know, it's Punch Drunk are known for doing these immersive shows where they totally take you out of your comfort zone, so you know that you're going to enter something like that. And what was going to happen in this show was going to be a the result of what happened in the first 3 hours, you know, which was this sort of passion play which Jude Law's character was being taken through, this initiation of some kind. But of course, lockdown came, and there was no way that anyone could get onto, you know, you could have 2,000 people on an island, and that was last September. So we decided that we were going to do it as a single camera film, you know, and still keep the 12 hours because it, you know, there's only certain times that you can get on and off the island, and it's 12 hours between those times. So there's got to be 12 hours, you know. You know, and then so we thought, you know, I suggested let's do it with just a single camera. We just like the, you know, we'll just be, just be like a member of the audience, you know, walking through this piece. And that was the easy bit, deciding to do it. After that, it was just like, God, how the bloody hell do we get this done, you know? But, you know, it was crazy. But there's been, you know, we had the outside broadcast teams and things like that, because it was all filmed. It was all broadcast live. So all that technical thing was all sort of sorted out. It was just more about the sort of logistics of getting a camera around this, you know, mile and a half of island and, you know, with all these extraordinary things happening, you know.
Were you having to rehearse then? Did you do a lot of rehearsal for this?
We didn't do a lot of rehearsal. We only had... Jude Law sort of 3 days before the actual broadcast of it. So Jude came in completely sort of fresh. I mean, you know, part of it was that if anyone's seen the series, the character
he wasn't fresh by the end of it.
No, no. No, I mean, he's just extraordinary. I'm in awe of him. But you know, he dragged that boat around for 8 hours. I mean, his commitment as well as his acting ability is amazing. The idea was to sort of try and his character wasn't aware of exactly what was going on. So it worked that actually, you know, he was being taken around by the men of the island in this initiation ceremony, you know, so that sort of worked. But yeah, there was a fair amount of initiating scenarios and, and rehearsals that went on in advance of that without, you know, in the few weeks before that.
I mean, it's probably for the best that he didn't know too much about what was going to happen, really, let's be honest. I did not feel sorry for him at some point. My God!
I know, he's a superhuman.
It absolutely is, and, absolute machine.
The loveliest bloke you're likely to meet, you know, and totally serious about the work. I mean, brilliant, you know. It would have been... I think he sort of went through this sort of out-of-body experience with it because he sort of... He was in character for, you know, whatever that was, 8 hours, being thrown into a grave, digging his own grave, dragging this boat round, you know, being crucified on this pylon out to sea, all that sort of thing. I mean, it was a real ordeal, you know.
Mm. But there's the great thing is that this harks back to starting out talking about Bermondsey Boy and Dave as your sort of quote unquote leading man. There seems to be, there has to be trust there between whether it's a subject or your actor and the director. And once there is complicity and there's trust, like an actor will just sort of fall, you know, and as long as they know that they're there to be caught, it's like, you know, I don't know what I'm eating at this restaurant, but I love this chef. So I'll eat anything he gives me and I know it's going to be great, even though maybe it's not to my taste, but the trust is there. And how important is it for you to begin the process before you get the actors on board with a trust between a casting director and also possibly a new writer? I know that's kind of two questions there, but we can split them up.
Yeah. The writer thing is a sort of different relationship. I mean, I have really good relationships with sort of quite a few writers that I've worked with over the years, and it's really about making sure that you communicate, especially in television where the writer is king, you know, you're absolutely communicating clearly whatever you're doing, so people are knowing all the time what... You know, if you are going to do, say, a 30-minute shot in one take, as it were, you know, some that actually everyone's knows that, so they don't think, oh, because Jack's scenes weren't written; they were all written as individual scenes for Help, so they, you know, it wasn't written like that. But I think it's just about communicating that and then asking questions and excavating everything that you can get out of a writer. With actors, for me, it's, I'm in awe of acting. I mean, I'm in awe of what you do. I mean, I can't even stand to hear my bloody voice ask a question on a documentary, let alone put myself in front of the camera. I think it's just, it's just incredibly brave and exposing. And I can understand why people get nervous, people don't have mistrust for what's going on around. I'm talking about actors, why actors get nervous, why actors have mistrust for what's going around them. And my process with actors is really sort of, I got a lot from working with Mike Lee, you know, who has this process of rehearsal that lasts, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks, where they originate the film through this rehearsal process. And it's really people sort of inhabiting the characters that they've created, you know. It's difficult to... I don't have that time, you know. I don't have that time to, you know, to do that sort of process. But I think the main... I always rehearse. I always rehearse in a rehearsal room. Everything that I do, I've always done that right from the very, very beginning. So there's a formal rehearsal process in a rehearsal room where people can make mistakes, they can experiment, they can make fools of themselves, and they can fail.
That's the place to fail.
Yeah, exactly. And it's all about supporting the actor to find that character and embody that character in a way that doesn't that exposes them, you know, less, as it were, you know, that's a really, really big thing for me, and it's a sort of, it's something that I've always insisted on and sort of fought for, because a lot of TV doesn't really either hasn't got the money to do it, or it, that, you know, people don't really believe in it. They think it's sort of a little bit wanky that you're going off to a rehearsal room and rehearsing, and, you know, maybe you're not even rehearsing the script. A lot of the time, we're not rehearsing the script. We might be talking, we might be sort of experimenting with what is that character, how does that character walk, how does that character think, you know, all those things, you know, which are there to you know, give the actor as much of an armory as possible when they're on the set. And then when we're on the set, then they're totally in character and know exactly what they're doing. So that trust thing is a big, you know, I work as hard as possible for people to get, you know, for me to get the actor's trust, you know, that's a big thing. And sometimes it's difficult. I think it can be, you know, I do lots of, you know, I mean, as a director, I'm still so learning about stuff, about making films, about working with actors, you know, even though I've been at it for a long while. And I, you know, I might say stupid things or I might do stupid things. It's all, you know, but it's, you know, so sometimes it's difficult, you know, sometimes we, you know, it's not as, it's, it all sounds very ideal that we have this sort of, you know, but sometimes it doesn't work out. But I think my ideal is to sort of have a supported cast, you know, that then can go in front of a camera, and it's not the first time that they're doing that.
Mm.
They're absolutely by that time burning to get on film, burning to sort of to play that character.
And also that, you know, even if it's not rehearsal time from the scripts, it's about talking, it's about building. Once you're on the floor in front of the camera, it gives you room to play in any different way. And also, there's not so much time solving problems, because we all know that once you get on the floor, all we're doing is like trying to solve this problem that we didn't suspect this was going to happen. And maybe we've sorted that out 10 days ago, and that's not going to eat into anybody's time.
No, that's right. I mean, that's definitely anything to do with script or story or anything like that. I don't want to be sorting that out on set, you know, when you've got everyone looking at their watch standing around you, you know.
And it is all about time, you know. It is tick-tock.
Yeah.
Let's not do that. And do you run into problems, or do you favour a certain channel over others? Because you do have a great relationship, obviously, with Channel 4. Do you feel, because I know that I've worked with writers and showrunners who go, well, I love working with Netflix because they leave me alone and I can just do what I need to do. Do you find that, without saying, you don't have, we're not, don't have to sort of say, well, I don't like that channel, I'm not, it's not that sort of base, but it's about being given the freedom to do what you need to do. Would you favour another channel over some others?
Well, the thing is that I think that, you know, the channels are really defined by the commissioning editors, and the commissioning editors, you know, like in drama anyway, the commissioning editors are changing all the time. You know, I mean, when we made Utopia, commissioning editor was Piers Wenger, who's now the commissioning editor at the head of the BBC. So you know, people move on, and in the time that I've been working with Channel 4, there's probably been about four or five changes of people, you know, that have gone through, you know, so each of them creates their own stamp in a way. But what I would say is I think because of the sort of work that I like to do, I'm probably more at home with those slightly less commercial channels like Channel 4 than say ITV. I haven't worked for ITV for a long time. I mean, they haven't asked me, but for some reason I can't think why. Maybe they saw the third day. I think I'm less at home than that. And obviously it's important to have sort of, you know, like really good relation. And what I was saying about, communicating to writers, it's the same thing with people at the channel. You know, you really want to be communicating with people so they're not going to get a nasty surprise about what you're suddenly producing.
But I think full stop, even from, you know, from your point of view or from an actor's point of view, it all boils down to communication. Everything runs off communication from the first saying what's going on. Everything, even on the floor, is about communication. So it makes sense that everything happens prior to the cameras rolling, that communication is key.
Yeah, yeah.
Just talking about your just sort of overall work, there is certain tones and themes that do come up again and again. Are these projects that you seek out, or are projects sort of, you know, fed to you or just land in your inbox, or is there a sort of tidy balance with that?
I do get sent a lot of stuff, and I'm definitely more at home with those elements which are sort of that are to do with conflict, and that's not to say that there can't, you know, there's not love there, or that, you know, that I couldn't do a romantic love story. But I am much more at home with the countercultural, the conflicted, people that are things that happen on the fringes of society, people that might be sort of on the fringes of society as well. So I've not really thought about this before, but I think, you know, my best work is probably comes out of that, rather than something which is, you know, I suppose a little bit more, just more entertainment, feel good entertainment. I'm not sure I do that particularly well.
Well, I say bring on the Mark Munden romantic comedy. That's what I say. Mark Munden, what an absolute pleasure you've been to talk to. Thank you so, so much for taking your time on a Sunday evening to talk to me. Yeah, I've loved it. Thanks, man. And congratulations on Help. Just absolutely class. Thank you, man. Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Another episode is done. Good news, the church bells have stopped after about 27 minutes of trying to record this outro. Bad news, the delicate cycle is still on, but I don't have any more time. I hope you had good news listening to that conversation with me and Mark. He's great. He's so great. I was really thrilled to get him on because, yeah, you know, I'm a big admirer of his work. But more importantly, he doesn't do a lot of these. So when he, you know, accepted the invitation to come on this and kind of knew what it was about, I was made up. And I spoke to a friend of mine who worked with him after I recorded last night. I went out to get some fish. You don't need to know this. And I said I was really buzzing that I had such a good conversation with Mark. So if you are new to Mark's work or you need to catch up yet, try and find Bermondsey Boy on YouTube, one of his first documentaries. Utopia is on Channel 4. National Treasure is on Channel 4. The Third Day, I don't know whether it's there. It might be on Sky. Catch up. So, I mean, I don't think the 12-hour live stream that we speak about is there. But yeah, certainly, if you're in the headspace, do try and watch Help with the wonderful Stephen Graham and past Two Shot podcast guest, the remarkable Jodie Comey. And she is, Jodie is remarkable in this film, I think. And then let me know what you thought of it. And if you haven't listened to Jodie's episode of this podcast, go back. We, before the world embraced Jodie Comer, we were there and got her on. I'm not sure if she's done loads of podcasts, but yeah, she certainly came on ours and we had a terrific chat, and I'm sure she'll come back at some point. Right, I'm going to go because I'm going to poach said fish again. You don't need to know that. Until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. You have been fantastic for downloading, subscribing, telling your friends, sending us emails. You know where we are. We're on all the socials at Two Shot Pod. If you want to send us an email, it's twoshotpod@gmail.com. You know we're on Patreon. If you can, if you feel, you can throw us some money every month, or just for 1 month, do as a one-off. That's absolutely fine. You know these podcasts are free, and we really hope you enjoy them. And it's been going for a fair few years now, hasn't it? So, as I said, until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast. I'll see you next week. Take care and stay safe. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.